You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2013 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. Jonathan Kirsch, I'm sure many of you know his work, has distinguished himself over the years not just as an outstanding writer, he's the author of 13 books, but as an advocate for writers as well as readers. He is a three-time president of Penn USA, an adjunct professor on the faculty of the Professional Publishing Institute at NYU, and he's also from a lineage of great writers. His father, Robert Kirsch, was for many years the esteemed book critic of the Los Angeles Times. There's a special award named for him at the Los Angeles Times Festival of Books. And Jonathan has had a distinguished career as a book critic, both at the LA Times and currently as book editor of the Jewish Journal. In addition, he makes time for a law practice. I don't know how he does it, specializing in intellectual property issues. Among his many books are The Grand Inquisitor's Manual, A History of Terror in the Name of God, God Against Gods, The History of the War Between Monotheism and Polytheism, and The Harlot by the Side of the Road, Forbidden Tales of the Bible. And in his new book, this marvelous book, his skills as both a lawyer and a virtuosic storyteller come together to specially great effect. The book with a great title is The Short, Strange Life of Herschel Grinspan, A Boy Avenger, A Nazi Diplomat, and A Murder in Paris. And that's what we're going to talk about tonight. So please welcome Jonathan Kirsch.
Thank you, Louise.
Thank you, Jonathan. Welcome. So in full disclosure, I should probably say you are my lawnsman. We're sort of
indeed
from the same area in the old country. And Culver City.
The old country of Culver
City. The old country of Culver City.
The
shtetl of Culver City, where we both studied with the great social studies teacher Clinton Boutwell.
Indeed.
And the great Rabbi Herschel Lyman.
Herschel Lyman, who performed the wedding between my wife, Anne, who's here tonight, and myself, and did the Pinyan HaBen for our firstborn son, Adam, who's the next in the Kirsch dynasty of book reviewers.
That's right, he is. There is definitely a Kirsch dynasty. So, Jonathan, this book has been long in the making. It's an amazing book. It's like I want to say you were made to write this book, but I should ask you first why you were drawn to this story.
Well, there is a story behind the book. My dad, Robert Kirsch, who you mentioned in your kind introduction, the author of many books of his own and both a novelist and a historian, in the 1970s, I would say 76, 77, told me the story of Herschel Grinspan, which I had not heard before, at least I don't recall hearing it before. And it's a story that's so compelling, that's so novelistic, it's like a noir thriller drawn from real life, and my dad wanted to write that book as a novel. So I heard about the events in Grinspan's life and his fate from my own father. Now, tragically, he fell ill shortly thereafter. He did not live long enough to write that book. My sister recently gave me a file, actually, after I'd finished my own book, I might have made good use of it if I'd gotten it earlier, a file of his notes and drafts. But I always cherished that story, and when I was casting about looking for a new project after my last book, I decided to return to the story that I'd first heard from my dad.
But was it also because, you know, it's a legal story? I mean, it's both. You knew it would draw on your particular amazing skill set as both a lawyer and a storyteller, right? I mean,
well, it's absolutely true that this is the story of a murder case, a murder investigation, two kinds of murder trials, one in the French judicial system and one a show trial in Nazi Germany. So a lot of the story takes place in police and judicial circles. So I think the fact that I came to it with a law background and much of my journalism before I started practicing law was about criminal justice. I'm sure that that enhanced my ability to parse out the documents and the charges. But I always like to say that the story is such a compelling human story, as many true crime stories are. It's really the story of a human life.
But it's very significant, I think, that Herschel Grinspan found you. I mean, that the story found you, and that you were here to tell the story. And we'll now try and unravel the story for you. I wanted to start with this wonderful quote that's sort of towards the end of your book from Primo Levi, where you say, and he's not talking, of course, about Herschel Grinspan. He's talking about something else. But he says, "A story like this one is not self-contained. It is pregnant, full of significance, asks more questions than it answers, sums up in itself the entire theme of the gray zone, and leaves one dangling. It shouts and clamors to be understood because in it one perceives a symbol, as in dreams and the signs of heaven." And I think that's really there in this book, very, very much so. So let's start with the basic facts of this story, the whodunit. Who was Herschel Grinspan?
Herschel Grinspan was a Polish Jew by citizenship, but born in Germany in 1921, the son of Polish Jews from Radomsk who had come to Germany in precisely the same way that thousands of other Jews had left Poland and gone to other countries, many of them coming to the United States, including your mishpocha and mine. To make a better life. Germany in 1911, when the Grinspan family left Poland, was seen as a place of opportunity for Jews, as a place of safety and security for Jews, a much safer place than the countries they were coming from, Russia, the Ukraine, Poland. He was born into a family with two other siblings, and they were very marginal Jews. You know, the Nazi propaganda line was that the Jews were wealthy manipulators of German civilization and polluters of German civilization. The Grinspans, like many of their fellow Jews in Germany, were poor, struggling, working Jews.
They were what you refer to and what you explain were Ostjuden. So tell us how they were regarded by the German Jews who'd been there for a longer period of time.
This is a very important concept, and it's something that you need to understand in order to understand not only Grinspan's story, but the whole dynamic of Nazi anti-Semitism. The Ostjuden, or the East Jews, the Jews from Russia, Poland, Ukraine, other countries of Eastern Europe, tended to be from smaller towns, from the shtetl system. They were craftsmen and workers. They were not businessmen. They were not in the professions. The German Jews, among whom they lived, were among the most assimilated and successful and affluent Jews in the world. And so there was a contrast on the streets of Germany between German Jews who were indistinguishable from other Germans and the Ostjuden, the Eastern Jews, who were quite readily identifiable. And so they were the first to attract the attention and the murderous hostility of the German regime. And of course, that is the first step towards the Holocaust, not yet the Holocaust, was taken against Ostjuden and not against German Jews. That's what triggered the events that pushed Herschel Grinspan into history.
Well, another word that I think is good to define is Heimatlos. Let's talk about what that meant, to be without a home, without a state.
Well, this, you know, we talk a lot about immigration law in the United States and the opportunity, a path towards citizenship. In Europe in the 30s, to have a piece of paper that allowed you to live legally in a particular country was literally and constantly a matter of life and death. To be without a state, to be homeless, was a dire threat to life. And it became ever more threatening as Germany became ever more aggressive. To leave Germany, you needed an exit permit, but to enter any other country of Europe, you needed a re-entry permit. The countries of Europe were not welcoming refugees from Germany, Jewish or otherwise, and so it became a condition of life to have that paper, that piece of paper. In the United States, it's not quite so dire, but for Herschel Greenspan and others like him, it was, as I say, a matter of life and death. Now, to move the story forward, starting in 1933 with the accession to power of Hitler and the Nazis, a campaign against the Jews in Germany was mounted and grew in intensity and ferocity.
You talk about it as the noose tightening, just these exactly. So many little restrictions from Jews can't own pets anymore, or you know, it was
exactly.
Just
you couldn't ride in a bus, you couldn't go to a park, you couldn't go to the circus. What they were faced with, Jews, and this was applicable to both German Jews and Ostjuden, was that German policy was to make life in Germany so miserable for the Jews that they would leave voluntarily.
Self-deportation, I believe it's called.
Exactly. It's yes. The old Romney idea.
Yes, yes.
But with a very ugly
with
face.
With a vengeance. Yeah. So the Greenspans decided, if they couldn't all get out of Germany in this dangerous time, that they would try and get their youngest son
exactly.
out, their youngest child out. So they found a way to get Herschel to Paris. And so the Paris he arrived in, what year was it he arrived in Paris?
He arrived in 1936.
1936. So I thought you could read this lovely passage where you tell us a little bit about what Paris was like when Herschel arrived there. Sorry.
Before I read, I'd just like to make the point. The word mishpocha, which is a Yiddish word for family, is it's kind of a leitmotif in the narrative. And the chain of transmission by which this boy, then only 15 years old, made his way out of Germany was all family. He had an uncle in Essen and an uncle in Brussels, two uncles in Paris, and they passed him along the
Even
line.
Though the two uncles in Paris didn't speak to each other.
Well, this is a family of one of the ironies, and I have to say I find it a little comical, is that this family, for whom family issues were paramount, and Greenspan again and again, Herschel again and again deployed his concern for his family and was motivated by it, none of them liked each other. It was filled with bickering and hatred and dysfunction. Right up till the crucial moment when Herschel took the step that made him a heroic historical figure. So, family only goes so far. I mean,
maybe, Jonathan, even before you read that, I think we have to give people a kind of more, a little bit of a physical portrait of Herschel before we place him in Paris. So he's young, he's slight, he's dreamy, right? He's not a great scholar.
It's true. He was not the dynamic youth of the Jewish movements of the 30s. You know, in the 30s, the Zionist movement was training and toughening Jews to build a homeland in Palestine and to fight against the dangers in Europe. Herschel never weighed more than 100 pounds. He was 5 feet tall. He always looked very childlike, always looked younger
sort of
than
a
his
dandy,
age.
Liked clothes.
He was a very, very stylish dresser. We have photographs of them that are inside the book in very dapper clothing. He cut a very elegant figure, but always on this kind of miniature scale. He was a little man. He was never a big man. What I always thought of as a dark, brooding, good looks. To me, he looked a lot like Sal Mineo. The first time I ever saw a picture of him.
That's a good comparison.
This audience may be old enough to know what I'm talking about. But Anne and I often talk about who should play him in the movie. You know, the problem is that when his story begins in earnest, he's 15 years old, and he's gone from history by the time he's 20. So it's a part for a young man.
So he was pretty happy, I think, to land in Paris. So what was the Paris like that he found?
Well, I'll read briefly from the
okay.
book. Paris, despite all of the internal turbulence and foreign peril, was still regarded as the city of light, a place of enchantment that had always attracted artists, writers, performers, and intellectuals from around the world. Ernest Hemingway and F. Scott Fitzgerald from America, James Joyce and Samuel Beckett from Ireland, Pablo Picasso and Salvador Dali from Spain, among many others. "I have two loves, my country and Paris," exclaimed Josephine Baker, the celebrated African-American chanteuse who was a fixture at the Folies Bergère. Her signature song, "J'ai deux amours," spoke for tens of thousands of foreigners who had lived in Paris and its environs, some as cultural expatriates like Gertrude Stein, some as political exiles like Leon Trotsky, and others as obscure illegal aliens like Herschel Grinspan. "I love France, second only to America," declared aviator Charles Lindbergh, who settled in the fashionable 16th arrondissement to escape the media frenzy that accompanied the kidnapping and murder of his baby, although his admiration for the Nazis prompted him to consider making his home in the Third Reich. "Above all else, Paris was a Mecca that excited the appetites of pleasure seekers and thrill seekers, bohemians and romantics, eccentrics and decadents. Josephine Baker, for example, performed the so-called danse sauvage for the tourists at the Folies Bergère with exposed breasts and a skirt fashioned out of faux bananas, a spectacle that would have attracted the attention of the vice squad back in her hometown of St. Louis. James Joyce's Ulysses and Henry Miller's Tropic of Cancer were both condemned as obscene in their native countries, but copies of the French editions were on sale at Shakespeare and Company on the Rue de l'Odéon. As if to symbolize the sexual services that were available from the filles de joie in the brothels and the poules on the boulevards, posters featuring a skull and crossbones and a stern warning, "Défendez-vous contre la syphilis," were displayed on the public urinals that were such a distinctive feature of the Paris landscape.
That's great. So here's the young dandy in Paris. He doesn't have a lot of money. His uncle gives him a little allowance every day, and he likes to hang out with his friends at the Tout Va Bien, his favorite cafe.
Great irony to that.
Yes, because that's a song that's, what is the song?
Well, the song was a hit on the radio in precisely this moment. This is one of the reasons that I say the story reads like a noir thriller, because these are the kinds of colorful atmospheric details that you would think a novelist made up, but it was not, it was all in history. There was a hit song that went, "Tout va bien, Madame le Marquis," and it was about a French aristocrat who calls to her country home, and her staff explains to her over the phone this chain of disasters that has taken place. Her husband set fire accidentally to the barn, and the barn burned down, and it spread to the house, and now the house is burned down. But at the end of each verse of the song, the servant back on the estate says, "Tout va bien," everything's okay, everything's all right.
Everything's okay.
And by a distinct irony, the cafe where Herschel Grinspan spent his time, even as all of the horrors in Europe began to mount, very much in his mind and attention, was also called Tout va bien.
So he was very aware of what was going on, and I'd like to talk now about the stresses he was under in Paris. So here he is, and he actually doesn't have a legal permit to be there. At one point, he's kind of living in an attic and not even coming out, figuring that, you know, no one will find him there for a while. He might slip out and go to the cafe at night. But he also starts to, then something happens as this noose starts to tighten the Germans towards the Jews in Germany. What happens when they start, what happens with his parents back in Hanover?
Well, the first thing I want to say is one of the striking details of this story is that this 15-year-old boy with imperfect French, who's in
very little French, right?
Almost none. He was known as by the French term métique. A métique was a word applied to foreigners whose poor command of the French language marked them as foreigners. He was that kind of resident of Paris. He and his uncle. I want to pause and say his uncle's name was Abraham, and he was a tailor. But he hung a sign on his apartment workshop, "Maison Albert. Herschel Grinspan was known to by his closest family as Hermann. His sister Esther was Berta. His brother Mordecai was Marcus. All of these were the kind of protective coloration that the Ostjuden took on in France as well as Germany to hide the fact they were Jewish, and not very well hidden. But his uncle Abraham, a tailor from Poland, and young Herschel had to master the intricacies of French immigration law. They had to go from consulate to police precinct, applying for the paperwork to maintain these exit visas and entry visas and residence permits. And they ran from pillar to post until they ran out of time. And at a certain terrible moment in young Herschel's life, the paperwork all expired. His German reentry permit expired, his Polish passport expired. Bear in mind that although born in Poland, born in Germany, he was considered by Germany to be a Polish citizen, and his passport was a Polish passport. So suddenly he was an illegal alien. He had no legal right to be in France, and if he was found on the street without papers, he would be arrested and deported, and he would be sent to one of two unattractive places, Poland, which had its own anti-Semitism, or Germany, where they were preparing to murder Jews.
So as Germany is expanding with its concept of Lebensraum, they wanted more room for German settlers, so they keep acquiring land which has Jews, so they have to get rid of the Jews on the land. This is before the Final Solution. So on October 27th, 1938, they have an expulsion order, and tell us about that.
This is a very crucial event in the history of Nazi anti-Semitism, and even more so in the life of Herschel Grinspan. Up until that moment, October of 38, the Germans' strategy was to make life so odious and so dangerous to Jews that they would leave. Hitler was dissatisfied with the pace of emigration by Jews, and he decided to accelerate it by expelling Jews, not making them so miserable that they would leave, but actually pushing them out. And the first target, the first Jews to be expelled, were the Ostjuden. These were 12,000 Polish Jews living in Germany, technically Polish citizens, and the decree was issued that in a single night they would be rounded up, arrested, taken to the border with Poland, and simply marched out of Germany and back into Poland. And on the night that this happened, the Polish frontier guards look up and see 12,000 Jews, men, women, children, grandparents, babies, carrying their luggage, coming through the forest on the German border, and they turn them back.
Because they had no idea they were coming.
They had no idea they were coming, and frankly, they didn't want them either. This was the great... another great irony of this story and all stories of German anti-Semitism, which is that as much noise as the Western democracies made about how bad German anti-Semitism was, none of the Western democracies were willing, or any country in the world, were willing to offer a safe harbor to Jews. So the point was made in the eyes of the world that nobody wants these Jews, not Germany, not Poland.
So they sat there, basically in this muddy field. There were I remember reading the Emanuel Ringelbaum diaries.
Sure.
That he came, there were people who came from Warsaw, Jews who came from Warsaw to try and give aid. But there was great suffering there. There were no accommodations. They were living out. So Herschel was hearing about his parents. His sister managed to send him a postcard.
Indeed. One thing we need to remember about Herschel Grinspan is that he was a very fretful, very frightened young man. Very high strung.
Yes.
Suffered from physical disorders, stomach problems. He would stutter. He was consumed with anxiety. And specifically, he was reading in the Yiddish papers about these 12,000 Jews, among whom were his father, his mother, his sister, his brother. And now, in retrospect, knowing what we know about what was to come very shortly thereafter, the plight of the refugees on the Polish border does not seem so horrible. They were suffering bad weather. They were suffering from lack of food and medicine. but they're not being taken to gas chambers. And in fact, they were housed at a former Polish army camp at Sebastian on the border, and the Emanuel Ringelbaum and other Jewish self-help workers came to that camp. These were the future resistors of the Warsaw Ghetto, but this was not yet the moment for that kind of resistance. They went to that refugee camp to offer food and medicine and clothing. But for Herschel, sitting in Paris, this was a source of torment, of anxiety.
You say he almost like he was prescient. He's like, he knew this was horrible, but it's almost like he had this foreboding of what was to come. I mean, you say this many times during the book. It's very striking. I mean, no one could know what was to come, but for him, it was already intolerable, you know, and that it should get worse was even more intolerable.
Well, I look on Herschel Grinspan's life story as proof of the saying that sometimes even paranoids have enemies. He was obviously a young man beset with anxiety and capable of imagining terrible things. And at the time he was imagining them, the rest of the Jewish world, and this is a very important part of his story as well, was saying, shah, shah, don't make noise, don't fight back, don't resist, this will pass, it has always passed before, it will pass now. Herschel couldn't accept that idea. For Herschel, he saw a catastrophe in front of his eyes and an even greater catastrophe to come. And I describe in the book a dream that he reported to the police interrogator after he was arrested for the crime we haven't actually touched on yet, but perhaps we will.
We're getting there.
He has a dream that's like a newsreel. It's a dream that depicts atrocities against the Jews, and I think we have to credit him with prescience at a time when the rest of the Jewish world was closing its eyes to the threat that Nazi Germany represented.
So he stomps out of the house one night after an argument with his uncle.
Yeah.
With some money in his pocket, how much is debatable. He writes a postcard to his parents that night. He goes to his favorite cafe, but he also buys a gun.
Well, his last night at liberty is a.
And you tell it so well, Jonathan. It's such a, you know, he buys a gun, and you have these great details. You know, he loads it in the sour-smelling laboratory of the cafe. It's very noir.
Yeah. Well, He's a boy who had no experience with firearms. He had a fight with his uncle. They were fighting about what could be done and what should be done for his parents, his mishpocha, back in the refugee camp on the Polish border.
I thought we didn't know what they were fighting about.
Well, we don't know with absolute certainty, but the one theory of the fight. I agree with you that the actual content of the fight was concealed. It was concealed for a very interesting reason, which is that the Nazis believed that there was a conspiracy at work there, and that what they were really arguing about was the crime that was being planned. The story that Herschel told and that his friends told was that he and his uncle were fighting about whether something more could and should be done to help the family. And Herschel, you know, like any temperamental teenager, stalks out of his house,
slams the door,
and goes off to nurse his wounded feelings. But then he takes a room at a little hotel that I visited. It's still there. It's still a hotel. He goes and sees a movie at the movie theater on the ground floor. That's still there.
What did he see that night?
We don't know exactly what he saw.
He buys a .45, but he says it's the only caliber he knew, and only because it was ubiquitous in the American movies that he watched.
He was a great movie fan. We know this. We went to the movies with his friends in Paris, other Polish Jewish refugees who hung out with him on the streets of Paris. He spends a night in this little flop house hotel, and the next morning he goes to a gun and knife shop. Again, I visited that shop. It's now a wholesale apparel outlet. It's no longer a gun store. But he was able to buy a gun and bullets without any identification, without any background check. It was very easy then, kind of like the way it is now in the United States. He had never fired a gun. The owner of the gun shop loaded it. When he put it in his pocket, it still had the price tag. Hanging from the trigger guard. He takes that gun to the German embassy in Paris. And he presents himself at the guard kiosk on the street in front of the embassy. He says, I need to see an official at the embassy. I have some important documents to turn over. Now, it says something about the time and place that this remarkable proposition from this little man, this little 5 feet, 100-pound boy, was taken seriously. They sent him in.
It's amazing, I mean, that they allowed him in.
Well, the explanation, which I report in my book, is that the German embassy was a hothouse of espionage, and so they were willing to hear any offers of secret information, however unlikely they might be. He was ushered into the office of a young German diplomat named Ernst von Roth. And von Roth's job as the third secretary of the legation, among other things, was to deal with callers at the embassy who had matters to discuss with the diplomatic staff. And so in a very matter-of-fact way, he said, so show me your papers. And at that moment, young Herschel takes the gun out of his pocket. He says, here are my papers, brandishing the gun. And he says, in the name of 12,000 Jews, and he fires. And he fires all as a...
five times, right?
Fires five shots. Now, I want to back up, because this is a subject of some compelling interest to me, and I did a lot of research on it. Herschel was a movie fan and loved American movies and did ask the gun shop owner for a 45, a Colt 45, a Western gun or an automatic, because those were the guns he saw in the movies. But he had also explained to the gun shop owner that he needed the weapon because he carried large sums of cash for his uncle. And so the gun shop owner says, well, you don't want a big gun like that. You want a concealable gun, and sold him a much smaller firearm that could be easily concealed. And that's an important fact.
Right.
Because when he fired these five shots, he was firing a low-velocity, small bullet. A 45 caliber bullet would have done much more damage. He fired five shots. He missed with three. He was 5 feet away from his target. His target was seated. He was seated. They were stationary. But one of the two bullets that hit the victim was a non-fatal wound. But the second of the bullets that actually struck von Roth damaged internal organs, which ultimately, 2 days later, led to his death.
So Herschel didn't run away. He didn't try and escape. He let himself be taken away. He was very voluble about it. He suddenly liked the celebrity of kind of being in the limelight.
Well, this is another thing that some people find it offensive. You know, my editor and I had kind of a debate about whether Herschel was an appealing guy or not. He was very grandiose about himself, and he reveled coming from complete and utter obscurity, a nobody, a nothing, an illegal alien, living, as you pointed out, in a garret in the top floor of an apartment building, hiding from the French police. Suddenly, he's the object of world attention. Diplomats around the world, journalists around the world, know who he is and know what he has done. He wanted to make a big noise, and he succeeded in making a big noise. And once he did, he savored the public attention.
Yeah, which is why it's kind of, you know, the reaction to him is manyfold, and one of them, well, the Nazis go nuts. They're like, they have their man. They're going to really. They have this. One of theirs has been assassinated, and now they're going to orchestrate a response. So this has been one of the contentious issues about Greenspan, and one of the reasons that he obviously has been held, you know, in you know, as my grandmother would say, you know, don't cause trouble.
Yeah.
You know, thank God it's not a Jew who did that. So here he makes this huge splash, and the next, what is the next thing that happens? How are they going to use this?
Well, I want to pause to say that one of the first things that happened is that a celebrity journalist in the United States, Dorothy Thompson, who's a celebrity broadcaster, a syndicated columnist, organized a defense fund and was able to raise enough money to hire a very celebrated, high-visibility lawyer.
But before Kristallnacht?
On the day of the shooting.
On the day of the shooting.
Okay. It was news. It was in the headlines. And so there was a media machine pumping out news about him from the Western side, and Dorothy Thompson's point of view was that he was a hero and should be championed and defended. The Nazis had their own media machine running at high velocity, and their argument was, we told you all along that the Jews were our vicious enemies, and here is proof. Now, their vicious enemy was, as I say, this by now 17-year-old boy, slight, frail, sickly, not much of a threat, firing an underpowered gun and so inept that he missed with three of the five shots. But for Nazi propaganda, this was sufficient. You know, I found in my research a picture that ran in Der Stürmer, which was one of the leading Nazi propaganda publications, and it shows the victim, von Roth, as a Christ-like figure on the cross, and his murderer is depicted to be a big, fat, ugly, bearded, stereotypical Jewish man, whereas the real killer was this slight, frail, rather good-looking and delicate boy. But they use Krinspan for propaganda purposes in order to vindicate their hatred and their anti-Semitic campaigns in the eyes of the world.
So this campaign of Kristallnacht, the officially sanctioned pogrom, so the on all appearances, the Nazis were saying, you know, here, because of this, you know, there is going to be a spontaneous
yeah,
eruption.
That's right. There is going to be a spontaneous eruption.
But you describe it so well, and I thought you could read this description.
Thank you.
And this book comes out actually on this is the 75th anniversary.
Yeah. I might say, by way of revealing a little secret, is that this book was due and done in 2011.
I know,
and
you had
I expected it to be published in 2012. And the Hochem at Norton said, well, you know, if we wait a year, we'll get the 75th anniversary. So that's how it worked out. And I also want to set up this passage, make the point that, as I've already told you, that von Roth did not die immediately. He sat in the hospital. Hitler sent his personal physician. There was a death vigil. And 2 days later, on November 9th, he finally succumbed. Now, that happened to be the day of a holy day in the Nazi calendar. This was the anniversary of the Beer Hall Putsch. And every year on that date, the high-ranking Nazis gathered in Munich to remember their martyred victims and to celebrate their success. And they always gathered for a speech by Hitler. Hitler declined to speak on that night, the night that von Roth died, but Goebbels took the microphone instead and announced the spontaneous demonstrations against this atrocity that would be undertaken. Thus began the officially sanctioned pogrom that the Nazis referred to cheekily and dismissively as Kristallnacht. In some towns and cities around Germany, as Goebbels noted, German mobs had already carried out acts of violence against Jewish targets on their own initiative. On the Unter den Linden in Berlin, for example, Jews who were queued up outside the French tourist office were set upon by a mob. "Down with the Jews," they chanted. "They are going to Paris to join the murderer." Even these incidents, however, owed something to the propaganda blitz that Goebbels had unleashed at 8:37 p.m. on November 7th, less than 12 hours after the shooting, when a directive was circulated to newspapers across Germany. Coverage of the shooting in Paris should dominate the front page, the editors were instructed, and editorials should emphasize that the attack on von Roth must have the most serious consequences for the Jews. Now those consequences will be revealed to the German people and played out as a kind of monstrous street theater for a worldwide audience. "I immediately gave the necessary instructions to the police and the party," Goebbels recorded in his diary after his address in Munich. Then I briefly speak in that vein to the party leadership. Stormy applause. All are instantly on the phones. Now the people will act. By midnight on November 9th, a set of detailed orders was issued systematically by teletype and telephone from Munich to party offices and police, army and SA units across Germany and Austria to make sure that spontaneous acts of violence were carried out precisely according to the official specifications. All Jews, and not merely Ostjuden, were to be disarmed, according to one such order. In the event of resistance, they are to be shot immediately. Synagogues were to be set afire, and Jewish-owned shops were to be vandalized by the brown shirts. But firemen and policemen were to make sure that the fires did not spread to Aryan property, and the Jewish shops were not looted. So meticulous were the planners of Kristallnacht that they even issued a list of phrases that were to be scrawled on the windows and walls of Jewish-owned businesses. Death to international Jewry was a beloved old trope of Nazi propaganda. No understanding with nations under the sway of Jews was on the list of approved graffiti, even if it was rather wordy for the brown shirts who were actually wielding the paintbrushes. The single most telling phrase of all was short, unvarnished in its meaning, and hot-wired to the headlines: revenge for the murder of Vamroff.
So the deed has happened. The damage has been done with worse to come. And a lot of the rest of your book, in a most profound way, deals with how this crime was regarded on many levels in the Jewish community then and forevermore. There are no streets named after Herschel Grinspan in Israel, for example. He's not considered a great hero. And this whole issue of, was he an avenger? Was he an idiot? Was he, Trotsky said what he did was inexpedient, which was kind of an understatement. You handle in a most fascinating way, and I wanted to read, because it's kind of like not of the norm, Herschel Grinspan's family was originally from the same town in Poland that my family was from, and I was reading in the Yiskor, the memory book from the town. In that town, apparently, they did consider him a hero, and I found this passage. It said, reading the words from his parents, let's see here. We Radomskers are close to him. He is our Landsman. His shot was a revolutionary shock from Jewish youth who cannot keep quiet while the enemy ruins Jewish lives and belongings with bestiality. With honor, we will always remember the name of Herschel Grinspan. And I thought that was unusual because reading in your book, what he was really considered, you know, what he did was so shameful because he rocked the boat. He didn't cause it, but it wasn't exactly a help.
Well, there's a lot to grapple with here. First of all, the claiming behavior of his own relatives is very touching to me, and those words resonate for me. But the rest of the Jewish world, and especially the Jewish world at that time, shunned him and disavowed him. The official Jewish community of Paris wrote a letter to Vamroth's parents.
That was really the worst.
A letter of condolence which they officially stated, we had nothing to do with this. And it was because he raised a weapon against Germany at a time when the Jewish world was still holding out hope that they could accommodate and appease and survive according to the strategies they have always used. There's another story I'd like to tell, and I would like to share it with you. Anne and I were recently on a trip to Europe. We went to Terezin, the transit camp outside of Prague, where about 125,000 Jews were held on the way to the death camps at Auschwitz. And our tour guide, a local Czech woman, felt it necessary to say that these Jews in their tens of thousands, as many as 26,000 at any one time, were guarded by only 22 SS men. And now it turns out I did some research about this. This is a lie. There were 7,000 German and Czech army soldiers there. But the point is, she was needling perhaps the sorest point in the story of the Holocaust, and making a criticism that Gideon Hausner, the prosecutor of Eichmann, made himself when he was questioning survivors of the Holocaust. Why did you not fight back? And the historians of the Holocaust have scoured the historical record for every single act that could arguably be called resistance. You know, the interesting one interesting example is the Onyx Shabbos resistance group of Emanuel Ringelbaum. Their resistance consisted of documenting the murder of millions of Jews and putting it in milk cans and burying it. I mean, it's a...
I think the whole idea of resistance has been, in hindsight, we know a lot more. I mean, hiding was also...
Well, I don't debate that.
I mean, I know you're not debating, but I'm saying that, that's this whole subject is the nerve center that your book looks at in many, many different directions, because this is, as you say, I'm quoting you, something profound is at stake in the debate over the extent and quality of Jewish resistance during the Holocaust. It's a huge subject, and this case is one that shoots, you know, the stories and the shoot out from it in many ways, and in a very masterful way, you unpack those different reactions.
Well, but I want to say that the most important problem that I'm addressing, the most vexing problem that I'm addressing in this book, and in many ways the reason I wrote this book, is that we look for every act that could be plausibly characterized as resistance, even if it was totally nonviolent. Some scholars say dying with dignity is an act of resistance, and yet we ignore the prescient youth who took a gun and spilled German blood to exact revenge for the persecution of Jews. That, to me, is a puzzle to be solved. That's the puzzle I'm trying to solve in my book. Why has he been written out of history at precisely the moment where we scour history for examples of resistance?
And here's where it gets really interesting.
Yeah, indeed. This is where the hot button
is. This is where the hot button comes in. So then they have the Germans have Herschel for a while. Well, he's in a jail in Paris, so he's under... he's under French jurisdiction.
Yes.
Eventually, and we won't go through the many phases where he finally gets into the hands of the Gestapo in Berlin, but they're preparing a huge show trial because they have this kind of, they want to show that he's part of a huge worldwide conspiracy that planned this this assassination. So, and then something odd happens. You know, there's various strategies proposed for how Herschel might plead, and you suggest that this might be one of the reasons why he gets written out of history.
I think it's exactly right. Louise and I were debating whether I should spill the scandalous secret, but I'm going to do it. I mean, there's a surprise in my book, and if you don't know the story of Herschel Greenspan, it would be a surprise. But it is in fact history. The celebrity lawyer who was hired by the defense committee to represent Herschel Greenspan in the French courts understood that in 1938, when France was cowering in abject fear of Germany and was doing everything it could to appease Germany and prevent Germany from going to war, in that environment, no French jury would acquit Herschel Greenspan if he testified that he assassinated a German diplomat as an act of protest against the mistreatment of Jews. It would be seen as yet more provocation, and the French wanted, just as the Jews did, to distance themselves from that act. The lawyer, his name was Vincent Di Moro Giafferi.
A Corsican, right?
A Corsican, a Frenchman of Corsican descent, and a tough guy. He took young Herschel aside in a prison cell, and he said, "No jury would acquit you for that crime, but they might acquit you if you testified that your victim was a sexual predator who seduced you, homosexually ruined you, and then discarded and abandoned you. That a French jury could get with. That would be a crime of passion. The crime of a spurned lover and a ruined child, the victim of sexual predation. Herschel, to his credit, said to his lawyer, I would never say that. I acted in righteous vengeance against the persecutors of my people. And that idea never entered the French record. In 1940, the war that the French so badly wanted to avoid at any cost finally came to their border. The German army conquered France in 6 weeks. Among the invading French German troops was an arrest squad whose job it was to find Herschel Grinspan and bring him back to Germany for the show trial that Adolf Hitler himself had ordered. One point I make in my book, and I think it's, a very central point, Adolf Hitler never heard the name Anne Frank. He never heard the name Primo Levi. He never heard of
Simon.
Exactly, Elie Wiesel. He never heard of any of the famous survivors of, or famous victims of the Holocaust. Hitler knew Herschel Grinspan by name. He wanted Herschel Grinspan as the defendant in a show trial, and that show trial was meant to provide a rationale for the murder of 6 million Jews.
Which is also, Jonathan, why you are able to find so much about him.
Exactly.
Because
right?
they kept such great records.
We had comprehensive documentary records of the French investigation, which were then seized and taken to Germany, and the Germans conducted their own exhaustive investigation. By the way, one of the investigators was Adolf Eichmann, who was sent into Herschel Grinspan's cell to interrogate him. Now, on the eve of his show trial, carefully prepared, carefully scripted, everything was scripted, including the verdict that was known in advance, and the death sentence was known in advance. Herschel Grinspan was alone in a cell in a Gestapo prison in Berlin being prepared for the trial. He was not tortured, and Eichmann makes this point. He was not tortured because they wanted him intact and unmarked for the show trial. It was meant to be a propaganda trial. At that moment, Herschel Grinspan has been deprived of his famous and expensive lawyers. He had a whole legal team, his doting family, crusading Western journalists. He was alone in a cell with a Gestapo interrogator, and he found it within himself to say to his captor, if you put me on trial, I will testify that the German diplomat whom I shot was a sexual predator who seduced me, ruined me, and abandoned me. And he understood, this is another act of prescience, he understood that he had only one weapon he could deploy to frustrate Hitler's plans to make him into a propaganda tool, and that was to touch on the thing that the Nazis hated perhaps nearly as much as they hated the Jews, and that was homosexuality.
And you say his greatest act of courage, and it was the reason he forfeited his role as a heroic avenger.
I think that in 1938, there's no question that it was the fact he was willing to fight back that forfeited him the confidence of his fellow Jews. And after the war, it was the embarrassment that he might have been a gay man.
Now, there's a whole other part of what happened to Herschel after all this, which we will leave for you to read in the book, because there's so much in this book. But Jonathan, it's a beautiful, beautiful book. I want to thank you so much for writing it. I'm so glad that the story found you. And I want to open up to you for your
thank
questions.
You. Thank you very much. Thank you.
And in case Herschel Grinspan is in the room, because they aren't
quite sure. He's been known to show up spectrally.
Question?
Hi, thank you for coming, and congratulations on your book, which I haven't had a chance to read. But based on what you said, it seems Herschel is one of these historical figures like John Brown who can be read a number of different ways, as you discussed.
Interesting comparison.
And also, his target was not as clear-cut as, say, Reinhard Heydrich. He was, you didn't say, but I don't know if he was a card-carrying Nazi or someone who was uncomfortable with Hitler. I mean, we don't really know that he was just working in this German embassy at the time. But anyway, having gone through all this process of reading the book, ultimately, what is your moral, ethical take on what he did? Was he a fool? Was he a terrorist? Was he a hero? How do you see him now, having written this book?
Well, I think that's a fair question, but it's a tough question. The question we have to ask, and I ask it in the book, is Herschel Greenspan more like Lee Harvey Oswald? That's the question I ask. Or is he more like the assassins of Heydrich? They are celebrated as heroes. Their target was considered to be an appropriate target of armed resistance to Nazi terror. Nobody accuses them of doing anything immoral. That's a close question because in 1938 we did not know, and he did not know, what we now know. So it's a closer question. It's also true that he was not an entirely sound mind. By the way, examples of that is that when he was sitting in a French cell, he was writing letters to world leaders. He wrote a letter to Roosevelt asking for help, and he even wrote a letter to Hitler saying that he would be capable of forgiving Hitler for his crimes against the Jews if Hitler would make an act of contrition. So he had a certain grandiosity that makes you question whether he was quite all there. But there is no question that, at least in my mind, that when you place him in the historical context in which he lived and died, and the enormity of the evil against which he was forced to struggle, I regard him as a righteous person and a hero.
Next question. If you had had the opportunity to read your father's file before you wrote the book, would you have changed the book? And so in what ways?
That's a very interesting question. No, I don't think I would have, because my dad's notes were cursory historical notes about the overall shape of the story. And as Louise pointed out, I was able to work in historical archives that were so exhaustively detailed that I had access to information that my dad had not seen. He could have done that work as well if he'd lived long enough to do it, but he had not.
I thought you were going to ask if he could ask Herschel.
Yeah, that would. Question. I've often thought about that.
But I was going to ask you if you feel like you know him.
Oh, I certainly do. You know, there's an experience that writers have when they are writing. It's kind of a transcendental experience, especially if you're writing fiction, where your characters begin to talk to you. You're not telling your characters what to do. Your characters seem at some level to be doing what they want to do and saying what they want to say. And that was absolutely my experience with Herschel. I felt very closely identified with him. I felt like I knew his mind and I recognized him as a kindred spirit.
Mm. And thank you for a very interesting presentation. Good to see you again. After all is said and done, did it make any difference?
Well, the first question that we should grapple with before I answer that question is Herschel Greenspan chargeable, as he has been charged, with some culpability for Kristallnacht? This is another reason why I think he is written out of history, is that people say, well, look at this terrible thing he brought down on the heads of his fellow Jews in Germany by shooting this diplomat out of spontaneous anger and resentment. Thousands suffered for his deed. I acquit him of that crime because the Kristallnacht history has amply proven was an atrocity waiting to happen. And all he did was provide them with a convenient pretext. And if he hadn't shot von Roth, they would have come up with a different pretext. But the other question is, did it make any difference in any positive way? the historians who I interviewed and whose work I read make the point that no act of resistance, not the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, not the uprisings within the camps, not the Bielski partisans, no act of armed Jewish resistance made any difference in the war with Germany. It was insignificant and inconsequential. But I quote a historian, and actually not a historian, a participant in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, who says of his fellow fighters in the Warsaw Ghetto, Jewish heroes of the resistance that we do not debate over. We recognize them as heroes. He says, there are men and women who for three lines in history will give their lives to show that not every Jew went like a sheep to the slaughter. Now that's a very controversial line. It's much debated in Jewish circles and Jewish historiography. But the other part of his observation, those three lines in history for which these young men and women died, I feel Herschel Grinspan deserves his three lines in history as well.
And Jonathan, it makes me think of how in, you know, the news of these acts of resistance, like in Radomsko in the ghetto, mm-hmm. they heard on their contraband radio about the Warsaw Uprising. So every act of resistance could inspire people to hang on. So it was that offering as well. When I say
and when the historians I consulted say they were insignificant in material terms,
right.
I think everybody that credits that in terms of morale, they were essential.
Right.
Hi, thank you. It sounds like a fascinating
and
interesting book. And maybe you just answered this, but on Kristallnacht, was planned before Grinspan. Do you find written evidence? Like you mentioned those phrases that they painted on the walls. Does that precede Grinspan? They're so well documented.
The approved graffiti, one of which refers specifically to Grinspan and von Roth, was opportunistic. It was prepared at the time von Roth had died. But we have, and again, this is not any new discovery on my part. There are well documented examples of orders going out to increase the capacity of the existing concentration camps at Dachau and Buchenwald in anticipation of mass arrests. One very intriguing piece of evidence is that prison uniforms in larger sizes were ordered on the theory that older men and stouter men were going to be brought in greater numbers in the near future. And that would indicate that mass arrests of Jews were contemplated, and so they needed more uniforms. There were SA units, brown shirt units, who were stocking axe handles in advance of, well in advance, months in advance of Kristallnacht. And that's been interpreted as evidence that they were preparing for some street action against the Jews. But the exact timing of it had not yet been decided. So I don't think there's any serious historian debates the proposition that Kristallnacht was not spontaneous. Its timing was opportunistic, but sooner or later, the Nazis were preparing to escalate their war against the Jews. The deportation of the 12,000 Polish Jews was one step. Kristallnacht was another step. And then when the Nazis conquered Poland and Western Russia and had places where they could kill in secret, that's when they kicked it into high gear.
So we have time for maybe two more questions.
You've already answered the question, but what other excuse could have been used for Kristallnacht?
I'm sorry?
What other excuse could have been used for Kristallnacht?
Well, you could imagine or speculate that they could find a reason, or if they couldn't find one, they would create one. One of the things that the Nazis did well and obsessively was to create evidence to justify what they wanted to do. The invasion of Poland, as you may know, was preceded by political prisoners in Polish uniforms being marched up to a radio station on the Polish-German border and shot. And this was meant to be evidence that the Poles had crossed into German territory, and so the German invasion of Poland was in fact an act of self-defense. One could readily imagine that some atrocity could be manufactured at the moment that the Nazis decided to launch a pogrom.
You were talking about Eichmann's interrogation.
Mm-hmm.
And I was curious to know whether that was well known and documented shortly after it occurred, or, and the reason I'm asking is I just recently saw the Hannah Arendt film, and as I'm sure you know, in talking about the banality of evil, she holds out that Eichmann was just this low-functioning, you know, basically goose-stepping guy that put people on trains effectively.
Well, first of all, I want to say that Hannah Arendt is a major figure in my book because, rather shockingly, she is has written what I regard as the most profoundly slanderous and insulting things about Herschel Grinspoon, who she accused of being not less than a paid Gestapo agent who assassinated von Roth to serve German interests, including to provide a pretext for Kristallnacht. She has no historical evidence for making this scandalous accusation, but she did. The fact that Eichmann was invited by Hitler, or not invited, but ordered by Hitler to go into Grinspan's cell is to me evidence of how high-ranking he was. He was the Nazi specialist on Jewish affairs. He was the man in charge of Jewish affairs. And so if there was a high-value, high-profile Jewish prisoner, it made every bit of sense to the Nazi regime to send Eichmann into that cell because he was the go-to guy for Jews. So I think that in the fact that he interrogated Grinspoon is evidence of his predominance and his preeminence in that field. It is little known that he did this because the interrogation of Eichmann on the subject of Grinspoon took place before the trial. It was done by the Israeli police interrogator who questioned Eichmann, and it was not, all those interrogation tapes were played at the Eichmann trial. There was no direct testimony about his role in the Grinspoon case.
I know there are more questions. You'll have a chance to chat with Jonathan out there at the book signing. Jonathan, I want to thank you again.
Thank you, Louise.
Thank you all for coming. It's a wonderful book, and if you enjoyed tonight's event...
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Errant Fox, City National Bank, KPMG, Donna and Martin J. Wolfe, and the Bujaki Foundation. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Council of the Library Foundation, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and LA Weekly. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.